This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of August 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. The Austin City Council votes to slash the police budget.
This is without a doubt the most significant change in Austin's public safety priorities in generations.
Census changes that could take political power and funding away from Texas Latinos.
It continues to get manipulated, whether it's through redistricting or then the allocation of resources.
And an Austin funeral home helping families grieve COVID-19 deaths loses its founder to the virus.
I told them my mother passed away and they go, oh my gosh, and you're here doing the funeral?
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
Mayor Adler?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Garza?
Yes.
Councilmember Alter?
Yes.
The vote was unanimous this week. Yes. Austin City Council members voted to reduce the police budget. They'll immediately cut and reinvest 5%, about $20 million. And the council flagged even more money to move over the next year. So it comes to $150 million total, about a third of the current APD budget. So that $20 million will be respent immediately on departments like Austin Public Health and EMS services. The rest of the $150 million, the biggest chunk, $80 million of that will be the city moving about a dozen divisions out from under the police department and either into offices or standalone departments. And then around $50 million is being put into a holdover fund, which council members say with community input, they'll decide how to spend over the next year. Councilmember Greg Kassar was among those who pushed hardest for these cuts, and he spoke after the vote.
I think that this is without a doubt the most significant change in Austin's public safety priorities in generations. This was only possible because we're in the midst of a local and national civil rights movement. And it was only possible because city leaders listened. We took democracy really seriously and listened and unanimously. This dais has done something I think that we should all feel really proud of. I think we've shown that we are shifting away from over-policing our community's challenges and instead funding community solutions.
The Austin police chief responded after the vote. Here's Brian Manley.
We are going to see some fundamental changes here at the police department, changes that we've not seen in my 30 years since I've been here. And this will be due to both the budget cuts that were made to the police department, as well as the plan that is in place to re-envision and to look at how we do policing in the future. With the reduction of 150 police officer positions in the Austin Police Department, we will go back to a staffing level that we were at back in 2015. So this will require some work with me and my team to address that staffing level so that we can ensure that we provide the highest level of public safety that we can to the community. Our patrol has always been our priority, our ability to respond to 911 calls for service. And although we've been challenged over the past couple of years with response times not meeting our goals, we will continue to strive towards meeting those goals, and we will ensure that our patrol bureau is staffed accordingly, even with these cuts. This will require us to move officers out of specialized assignments and units and potentially impact the operations there. But it's important for the community to understand that we will ensure that our patrol functions remain at full staffing at the levels that we're at today so that we can ensure our ability to respond to those 911 and 311 calls for service.
The Travis County Republican Party has responded to APD's cuts, calling them unconscionable and saying they will make the city less safe. Travis GOP Chairman Matt Makowiak says because Austin is one of the fastest growing cities in America, it should be hiring more police, and he's calling on people to vote council members out of office. But policing is not the only issue in the budget. The Austin City Council has voted to place two transportation related ballot measures in front of voters in November. One calls for a bond issue for sidewalk, bikeway, and other infrastructure improvements. KUT Samuel King reports the other would raise taxes to pay for new transit lines.
If voters approve, an Austinite whose property is worth around $400,000 would pay roughly $350 a year in taxes to help fund public transit. The Project Connect plans include new train and bus lines, as well as a new downtown transit tunnel. Councilmember Jimmy Flanagan says the new tax would be the most fiscally responsible way to fund the transit expansion.
We are not talking about a future obligation we won't be able to fund. We are not setting ourselves up for failure like other cities and other transit agencies have done across the country. This is a long-term, sustainable funding source.
The tax could raise billions of dollars. Officials anticipate the rest of the funding for the $7 billion plan would come from the federal government. Opponents say the funding plan and timetable are unrealistic. Samuel King, KUT News.
Okay, let's talk to Austin's mayor about the police cuts and the public transit project. Steve Adler is Austin's mayor. Hello, mayor.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Some groups call these cuts baby steps because you're doing the $20 million APD cut now and then the bigger chunk later. Do you share those concerns about this issue possibly losing political momentum?
I don't think so. I think that we are in a different world now, in so many ways than we were before. I think this is a community that's seen the disparities that exist that have just been in our face associated with the virus. You know, it's like somebody grabbing both sides of your face and not letting you look away. It's the community here, as communities across the country, are now seeing institutional unfairness, and I think that we're all going to be moving forward to change those things, especially here in Austin, because I think it is part of who we are in our culture.
Conversely, not everyone supports the reduction in APD's budget. How do you explain the $150 million cut to them?
Well, I find that when people actually understand what it is that we actually did yesterday, then it makes a lot more sense to those folks. We took a little over $20 million out of the police department by cutting unfilled positions and overtime. And the cadet classes. We didn't cut any current officers. It's going to have no impact on 911 response. But we took that measure of cuts and we are investing it directly into taking people out of camps and putting them into homes, expanding EMS to take up more of the medical calls that police are doing now, providing places for women who want to leave abusive situations before they get hurt, and increasing the number of mental health first responders. People understand that kind of investment, and they understand why that's an important thing for us to do, and why doing all of those things are going to better enable our police officers to focus on crime. That's $20 million. There's another $80 million bucket that we're talking about keeping the functions remaining, but maybe under independent leadership, like forensics, which people understand, like combining 911 or 311 or integrating them. That's an important thing for us to do, and people understand that administrative services don't necessarily need to be in the department. And people like the idea of internal affairs not having to report up the same chain of command that they investigate. And that's what that $80 million is for. It's not making the functions go away. It's having more independent control, and people understand that. The last bucket, the $50 million in the last bucket, are ideas that we're not ordering and haven't said they're the right thing to do. They're the things we want to investigate. Maybe it is better to take training and recruiting and make that independent. Let the police officers be adjunct professors, but have the actual administration being something other than the police force, lake and park police, traffic enforcement, loud noise enforcement that our police do downtown. Maybe these are the kinds of things that our police should not be doing. And that's what that last $50 million bucket was. We're not doing it, but we're saying, let's just take a look at those to see if those are good ideas or not. So when you explain to people what the $150 million is, for people that have reservations and they understand the detail of it, I'm finding that most people understand it and go, well, that makes sense. But there's concern that we were taking just $150 million and ordering it out of the police department budget, and that's not what we did.
I want to move on from that because there's another really big issue that the city council tackled yesterday, and that is public transit. Project Connect, an ambitious project, new rail lines. It would have a rail tunnel through downtown with underground stations, expanded commuter rail, new Metro Rapid and Metro Express service. Of course, it comes with a big price tag, and it will go to voters in November for the owner of a $400,000 home. My understanding would be an increase of roughly $350 a year in property taxes. How concerned are you about requesting a relatively large tax hike from voters during a recession, during a pandemic?
You know, it feels like forever, although it might just be two decades, that everywhere I go, people say to me as the very first thing, when are you going to do something about traffic in Austin? When are you going to actually do something that is big enough to actually fix it? Well, this is what that is. And I think it's something that people want. I think that dealing with traffic, ensuring that we have a more equitable mobility system by providing travel opportunities to people in travel and mobility deserts, really doing something real with respect to climate change emissions, reducing fatalities. These are all things that are incredibly important. And this project makes the largest investment ever associated with a transit project anywhere in the country, associated with making sure that housing remains affordable in and around stations and transit corridors, the largest investment. So this reflects so much of what Austin's values are. And frankly, as we come out of this virus, this is going to be a huge job program for a lot of people in our community that probably are not going to have the same job they had before to go back to.
But as much as people are concerned about traffic, I'm sure you hear the complaints about affordability and property taxes as well, right? And how concerned are you that especially during a time when so many people have lost jobs or their earnings have been cut, that they're going to sign up, check that box saying, yes, I will pay hundreds more in property taxes per year for a public transit program that may not directly benefit them?
I think it's going to directly benefit almost everybody in the city, but I understand what you're saying. I mean, it has a price tag, and I don't take that lightly. And for that reason, it is a concern. But I think that the overwhelming number of people recognize that for the benefit that we achieve in this community on what has been our highest community priority for almost 20 years, that we're going to have to do something big if our challenge is big. And this challenge that we have in this city is huge. So it is a concern. I recognize there's a price tag, but the benefits are just so great that I think it's going to have pretty significant support.
Finally, the media, of course, has very limited bandwidth and has been focused on these two major items, APD and Project Connect. But I'm wondering, Mayor, what is the biggest piece of the budget that's flying under the radar and not getting enough attention from your perspective?
The investment that we're making in homelessness, in getting people out of camps and into permanent supportive and transition housing, so that they can stabilize their lives. The money that we're providing to gear up programs like Caritas that has a 95% success rate when it can take somebody off the street and get them into permanent supportive housing so they don't go back. It's increasing the capacity of organizations like SAFE to take women out of abusive situations and into safe places before they just become a crime statistic. I'm just really excited about those efforts.
Steve Adler is Austin's mayor. Thanks for your time, Mayor.
Thank you.
Austin. Austin health officials are urging people to get tested for the coronavirus. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, Austin's top doctor is stressing the importance of consistent testing.
Dr. Mark Escott of Austin Public Health says the Austin area has seen a couple of positive updates within the last week. The doubling time for the coronavirus has risen to 85 days, a record high since the start of the pandemic. Escott says that's a good sign, especially as schools prepare to reopen in a limited capacity within the next few weeks. But Escott told Travis County commissioners that health officials have seen a drop-off in people seeking COVID-19 tests in recent weeks.
We are seeing what's being seen in many parts of the country right now. And that's a significant decrease in the testing that's being done. So a few weeks ago, we were over 6,000 tests in a week. Last week, through our public enrollment testing, we didn't even hit 1,400. This is not because tests are not available. It's because less individuals are signing up for testing.
Escott urged anyone with or without COVID-19 symptoms to get tested. Last week, Austin Public Health reopened testing to patients without symptoms. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
Statewide, Governor Greg Abbott says coronavirus case numbers are slowly moving in the right direction, but he points out the virus is much more prevalent than it was in the spring.
Even though the numbers of COVID-19 have improved, COVID-19 has not left the state of Texas. COVID-19 still spreads across this region and across the country just as fast as it did in July when you hit high numbers in deaths, high numbers in hospitalizations.
The state says fewer than 7,000 COVID patients are in Texas hospitals right now. That is down from last month when it was above 10,000, but the number of hospitalized patients today is more than four times what it was in May. Today is the 13th day in a row of triple-digit heat for the Austin area, with more of the same expected through the weekend. Texas summers are supposed to be hot, but as KUT's Mills Bouchel reports, there's nothing normal about this heat, even if it's starting to feel that way.
Temperature records for Austin go back to 1898. In the first 100 years of record keeping, there were only 8 times when triple-digit heat waves lasted 10 days or longer. But since the turn of this century, there have been 14 such heat waves, including our current one. So, if all you've known is Austin weather for the last 20 years, you'd be forgiven for thinking this kind of thing is normal, even though it really isn't. Now, two things are causing this trend. One is called the urban heat island effect. It's where asphalt and concrete absorb heat, then radiate it back into the air. The other cause is global warming. That's helped the average number of triple-digit days in Austin go from about 13 annually last century to around, so far, 38 this century. One report out last summer forecasted that the feels-like temperature in Austin could start to surpass 127 degrees by mid-century if world governments fail to do anything to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Mos Bouchel, KUT News.
Passenger traffic at Austin Bergstrom International was down in June by just under 82% compared to a year earlier, a drop of more than 80%. That meant fewer than 292,000 passengers moved through the airport. It was an improvement over May of this year when passenger traffic was down by more than 90% from May of 2019. The Big 12 Conference is planning to move forward with football, volleyball, and women's soccer seasons in the fall. But as KUT's Jimmy Moss tells us, the conference is building a lot of contingencies into its schedule should virus conditions get worse.
The official announcement comes a day after the college football landscape was changed, with two of the five biggest conferences, the Pac-12 and Big Ten, opting to postpone fall sports with an eye toward the spring. Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby said the spring is not realistic, and they are still planning on football in the fall.
Nobody has told us that it's poorly advised to go forward and do what we are doing.
But, he added, they are prepared if virus conditions change. The conference is limiting volleyball and soccer regular seasons to Big 12 opponents only. It will continue with its plan for football of 9 conference games and just 1 non-conference opponent, with off weeks built in if games need to be moved. Texas, Baylor, TCU, and Texas Tech will start conference play on September 26th. Texas State University, by the way, is still planning to play football against SMU Labor Day weekend in San Marcos. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
Texas Latinos have experienced massive population growth in the last decade, yet those communities are poised to be significantly undercounted in this year's census. That means Latinos could face a decade of diminished political power and underfunding for essential government services. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports this comes at a time when Latinos are being disproportionately affected by the coronavirus pandemic.
Texas's overall population growth has been staggering in the past decade, and a lot of that growth has been among Latinos. Lila Valencia, a senior demographer at the Texas Demographic Center at UT San Antonio, says Latinos made up half of the state's growth between 2010 and 2019.
They are adding the largest numbers of people to the Texas population of any of the race ethnicity groups.
And this is why Latino civic groups across the country had been preparing for the census. The national headcount that happens every 10 years. It determines how much federal funding states and communities get, as well as how much political representation they get. Genesis Sanchez is the Texas Regional Census Campaign Manager for NALEO, a Latino civic and political engagement organization. She says the stakes for Latinos were really high.
Because if we don't get counted as, you know, the second largest demographic group in the United States and in Texas, then we won't have our political power. It continues to get manipulated, whether it's through redistricting or then the allocation of resources.
And even in a normal census year, racial minority groups and immigrant communities are traditionally less likely to respond to the census, either online, over the phone, or by mail. Alice E. is with the Austin Asian Complaint Count Committee.
And we have a language barrier. We also have knowledge barrier. Not so many immigrant family does not know what a census is about.
And E says there's also a lot of mistrust among immigrant communities when it comes to the Trump administration, which fought and failed to add a citizenship question to the census.
We are worried. We are scared about this administration, what they can do. They don't trust the government when using the census data.
E says now there are even more worries following a recent memo from the White House directing state lawmakers across the country to exclude undocumented people when they draw up political boundaries next year. State Representative Eddie Rodriguez from Austin says this has all been a blatant effort to suppress the influence of Latinos as Texas is poised to gain more congressional seats next year.
And I think it's done for political reasons. I believe that the Trump administration, knows that through apportionment on the congressional side, that many states stand to gain more seats, and those seats may be Democratic. And I think this is an attempt to stem that.
Another blow, Rodriguez says, was the Trump administration's recent decision to stop the census a month earlier than previously planned. Instead of finishing in late October, workers now have to finish by the end of next month. Demographer Lila Valencia says that's a big worry for communities that haven't been responding to the census.
In the state of Texas, some of the areas that have the lowest response rates to the 2020 census are also areas of the state that have large shares of Hispanic populations.
Valencia says she's been looking at how different counties and communities within Texas have been responding to the census this year compared to 2010. That was the last census year and also happens to be an undercount. She says the five Texas counties with the largest number of Latinos haven't been able to meet or exceed their 2010 response rate.
And so that really means that the Census Bureau will have more work to do than they did in 2010, and they'll also have less time to do it in.
Valencia says there are also a lot of rural areas with large Hispanic populations that don't have regular postal service or bad internet service, as well as high rates of poverty. Valencia says there are about 51 counties in the state in the lowest percentile of response rates.
About 22 of those counties, or 43% of them, have more than 50% of their population identify as Hispanic.
And that's why census workers needed more time to knock on people's doors who haven't responded to the census yet, says Katie Martin Lightfoot with a public policy group called Every Texan.
Unfortunately, with one COVID-19
restricting in-person outreach events, and two, now with the Census Bureau lessening their timeline by a month, there is a great fear, again, that folks that have been historically undercounted are going to be undercounted again on this 2020 census.
Lightfoot says census workers are trying really hard to make this new deadline, but they haven't been able to start work in the places where undercounting happens the most.
They have started the door-to-door knocking in Texas, but they've only started in the major cities. And so when we think about places like the Valley or West Texas, where there are like these high concentrations of Latinos, there is a big fear there that, again, they're going to be missed.
Besides losing potential political representation, Genesis Sanchez with Naleo says Latino communities also face being underfunded for things like healthcare, food assistance, transportation, and education for the next 10 years. And in that time, the Latino community will probably be recovering from the devastating effects of the pandemic.
COVID hit Latinos particularly hard, especially here in Texas, and especially in places like El Paso, South Texas, and the RGV. And so you had this double whammy kind of situation.
According to state health officials, Hispanic Texans make up about 40% of the state's population, but 48% of the state's confirmed COVID-19 deaths. In Austin, Latinos are twice as likely to be hospitalized for COVID. And according to the Pew Research Center, unemployment among Latinos peaked at almost 19% earlier this year. Sanchez says she thinks this is a particularly painful time to set up Latinos for inadequate government services and a diminished political voice.
Our communities are really suffering, and they're distracted. They're not thinking about how they're going to participate in the census, or, you know, they can't envision a long term when their short term is so difficult. And so it just feels unbelievably cruel to attack our communities over and over again in the middle of a pandemic.
Sanchez says Texas Latinos are resilient, though. She says no matter what happens, those communities will get through this. In the meantime, there are volunteers phone banking across the state, hoping to convince people in those undercounted areas to respond to the census before it's too late. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
The Austin Independent School District has a new superintendent, Stephanie Elizalde. The school board voted this week to hire her. KUT's Claire McInerney had a chance to speak with the new leader of Austin Schools.
Elizalde comes to Austin from Dallas ISD, where she was a district administrator. One of the first things I asked her about was how she's going to lead AISD during this really challenging year. COVID-19 has forced the district to do virtual learning for the first month, and most students will be doing virtual learning for 2 months. But she says that every family is in a different situation when it comes to the pandemic, so the district has to take that into consideration as it plans virtual learning and eventually in-person learning.
You have to balance out that there has to be a foundation of consistency that everyone can expect. And at the same time, there has to be some nimbleness to the organization to adapt to the different needs of different communities. And so I think we start off with the overall health concerns, and then we have to individualize. And that does take a lot of work, because it's like, well, everybody's not going to get exactly the same thing. And the answer is that's correct. And we're not going to apologize for not treating everyone exactly the same, because fairness is, in my definition, not about treating everybody the same. It's about treating them with what their needs are.
Another huge task she'll face as Austin ISD's new superintendent is addressing equity in the district. It's something that's coming to the forefront more and more in AISD, with the first chief equity officer hired last year and an upcoming equity audit of the district's policies. She says she hopes that the assessment will look at 3 major areas. One is teacher quality, and if more experienced teachers are in schools with higher need. Also,
I think looking at the curriculum, I know there's quite a bit of autonomy campus to campus in Austin, but all the kids deserve the good stuff. So I do think I have to have a conversation about how we determine the actual instructional lessons that are rolled out. And again, without becoming super prescriptive, because I don't think I don't think this is about prescriptiveness. I think it's about holding us to certain quality control. Every kid should have access to this level of rigorous curriculum. And it should be culturally responsive and culturally integrated. And then I think just it's important to look at the dollars that we are spending on which campuses with which students. And not just the total dollars, but what are the dollars actually being spent on? Because we could be spending more money. Does that actually mean that they're getting more?
But achieving equity in Austin is definitely a challenge. Compared to Dallas, Austin ISD is much more diverse when it comes to the different experiences children have. Around half of AISD families live near the poverty line, and the other half are much more financially comfortable. So when it comes to school, all of these children need different things. And as the incoming AISD superintendent said, every parent is trying to advocate for what they think is best for their kid.
The challenge is to ensure that every child is getting what they need based on what the needs are without other entities feeling that we've taken from their child to give to someone else's child. Well, that requires a lot of introspection, because we actually have to define then, and I'm going to use one of those crazy research terms, but for whatever reason, it's in my head. What's the unit of analysis of when we say our district? Is our district one particular side or one particular portion of our community? Or do we define our district as our district?
One way this equity debate played out recently in AISD was when the district closed schools last year. The original proposal was to close 12 schools, and most of those schools have a lot of low-income students and students of color. The situations that prompted the district to consider closures, low enrollment, families moving to cheaper areas of the region, and charter schools, aren't going away, so closures might come up again. If so, Elizalde says she learned a lot about how to do this right from her time in Dallas.
And when we do this, whether we intend to, I know we don't intend to, and I have had to be faced with doing school closures in Dallas ISD. And I would say the first time we embarked on it, we did not do a good job of bringing the community in on the forefront. We need to get the communities involved in the conversations up front. Too often, when even if it's the right decision and it makes complete logical sense, there's a lot of emotion involved in these decisions, as there should be. Everybody needs to feel valued.
Stephanie Elizalde's first day on the job as AISD's new superintendent was Wednesday. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
In many ways, funeral home employees could be considered frontline workers during the COVID-19 pandemic. That's what one owner of a funeral home in Austin believes, anyway. At this funeral home, people have been working 7 days a week to help families bury those who have been killed by the virus. And then the funeral home lost one of its own. KUT's Audrey McClinchy reports.
For the first time in its long history, the doors to Mission Funeral Home in East Austin are locked during business hours. You need an appointment to get in. That's not to keep the grief of families out. Grief is something employees here are ready to face close up. That's to keep out the coronavirus.
We're going to have to take the precautions for the family too, and also for ourselves, because we have to continue to help people.
Charles Villaseñor is the president of Mission Funeral Homes. Lately, he's been working long and odd hours, and something he's accustomed to. Death is unpredictable. But lately, death has been especially relentless.
Since we're having so many different cases, we have to work every single day. And it's been tough.
Many of the families that come to Mission Funeral Home are Hispanic. Hispanic people have been disproportionately affected by the virus. For example, last week in the Austin area, just over half of coronavirus cases were among Hispanic people, in a region where the population's about one-third. Charles said the funeral home didn't see many COVID cases until a couple months into the pandemic.
Okay, so after July 4th, are when things really started to change.
A few days later, the Austin area reported 753 new cases, the most in one day. The deaths followed.
By the 12th of July, we were seeing two cases every couple of days. And we were averaging, you know, maybe three or four a week. And then all of a sudden, it turned into three or four a day.
Until late July, when they had 10 cases in one day. That same week, Charles's mother died.
The families depend on us. And so, you know, so that's what's happening now, is that we're having to just keep going and going and going. Even through my own mother's death, I'm having to make sure that funerals are done every single day.
On July 28th, Charles's mom, Lois Villaseñor, died from complications due to COVID-19. Her funeral was at a church in East Austin. Several dozen people came out, keeping their distance and wearing their masks. A mariachi band played. Others, like myself, watched a live video stream. Lois and her husband, also named Charles, opened Mission Funeral Home in 1959. Friends said they quickly became an important part of the Mexican-American neighborhood they moved to.
I admired Loisa for her place in this community.
Texas State Senator Carol Alvarado.
And it is because of that foundation that they laid, the real estate that they bought, the businesses that they helped build, why this particular part of Austin can grow and prosper.
In 1989, Lois was the first Hispanic woman appointed to the state's funeral commission. She was an accomplished business owner, fiercely loyal to her family. She loved painting and taking day trips to San Antonio. She also had a bit of a daring streak. Lois had a pilot's license and apparently would fly in her off time. She's now buried, along with her husband, in the Texas State Cemetery under a gravestone featuring Our Lady of Guadalupe. Her longtime friend, Elisa May, told this story at the funeral.
She felt a deep responsibility to bring the powerful Hispanic religious icon to the state cemetery.
But May says Lois didn't get this done without a fight.
She had to make multiple requests from state officials to allow her to have her way. Our Lady of Guadalupe will be there by her side, along with her beloved husband, Charles, for the state to witness the strength of the Hispanic culture. Will be forever loved and remembered. Vaya con Dios, Mrs. V.
Lois was 87 when she died. She'd been living with dementia while two aides cared for her. The first symptoms of COVID-19 were unusual, her son said. She complained of sore legs. Then she had trouble breathing. She was in the hospital for 1 week, on a ventilator for most of that time, before she died. Charles, Lois's son, says he now shares an understanding with many of the families that come to Mission Funeral Home. With the coronavirus, you lose someone suddenly.
It's far more traumatic for the family because everything happened very quickly and they don't know where it came from. They don't know how the person got it. And of course, they're concerned and they're very, very overtaken.
Hospitals typically don't allow people to visit COVID-19 patients. So death is often the first time families can see their loved ones since they got sick.
The situation really calls for us to prepare the loved one for the family, set the features, wash the hair, comb the hair. Make sure that the family member is able to see the loved one.
They also need to disinfect the body so a family can come close without worrying about getting the virus. Embalming, typically done to preserve bodies, also disinfects. And in some cases, says Charles, families that plan to cremate their loved ones ask first that they be embalmed and dressed, as if preparing them for an open casket, just so a family can get close and see them.
We see the families on television that can see their loved one or touch the glass. You know, on the other side, that's not always the case.
Charles and his siblings were last able to see their mom via a Zoom call from the hospital. The day after she died, he went back to work.
I had a funeral with the family. I told them my mother had passed away, and they go, "Oh my gosh, and you're here doing the funeral?" Well, my mother would have wanted me to be there. She would want me to go out there and do your job.
Charles says the number of coronavirus tests the funeral home's handling has gone down. After burying his mom, Charles says he felt a sense of relief. There hadn't been any COVID calls to the funeral home that day. But then he corrected himself. There'd been two. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Santo, 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 Señor Dios de los ejércitos.
That's KUT Weekend for the third weekend of August 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. And email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶